Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, candidates for governor say they can do something about high prescription drug prices. Can they? Here's Congressman Tim Walz last week acknowledging that the pharmaceutical industry is a formidable opponent.
We as a state need to do something on cost containment on pharmaceuticals. The thing that I think we need to be realistic about is how powerful this lobby is, because I am still at a loss, because I've worked a lot with veteran suicides and in veterans issues, this opioid epidemic, and the audacity of drug companies to lobby against the penny a pill that Governor Dayton and so many others have proposed to fund treatment and prevention just goes to show you the fight that we're up against.
Congressman Tim Walz, in a recent conversation with me in studio about pharmaceutical prices, President Trump also says he's ready to take on Big Pharma. Here's his announcement in May.
Our plan bans the pharmacist gag rule, which punishes pharmacists for telling patients how to save money. This is a total ripoff, and we are ending it. We are getting tough on the drug makers that exploit our patent laws to choke out competition. Our patent system will reward innovation, but it will not be used as a shield to protect unfair monopolies.
So today, a conversation with two guests about what would really work to bring down prescription drug prices and whether politicians have the political will to take on the pharmaceutical industry. Donald Trump may rail against Big Pharma, but he has filled key positions in his administration with people close to the industry, including his Health and Human Services Secretary. So as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you. Do you have prescriptions that are so expensive they're almost out of reach for you? And do you think the federal government should be in the business of telling drug makers what they can charge? What does that say about this argument of the free market? So your own personal experience with this, and then a wider question about whether you think the federal government should be in the business of telling drug makers what they can charge for their own products. Here's the phone number, 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Dr. Robert Book, is a health economist and senior research director at Libris Research, LLC. He's with us from Washington. Robert, our first name's all right with you. Welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right. Really good to have you on the show. Pinar Karaja-Mandich is the academic director of the Medical Industry Leadership Institute at the Carlson School of Management, and she's with me in the studio. Pinar, welcome. Really good to have you on the show. First name's okay with you.
Perfect. Thanks
Great.
So much.
Good to have you here. Pinar, RAND Corporation recently reported again that Americans spend almost twice as much on prescription drugs than Europeans do. Part of the reason for that is that we use more prescriptions than Europeans do. Why is that? Do we know?
So that's a very interesting question. I mean, the first point you made, that our prescription drug spending in the U.S. is about double of the Europeans and other comparable OECD countries. Part of it is related, of course, to maybe our healthcare system, and we're using maybe more drugs, but probably more of the discrepancy is due to the differences in the prices that we end up paying for the drugs in the U.S. versus other countries in Europe, most of which have single-payer health systems where they actually use their government entities to negotiate drug prices for them.
So, Robert, prices look high here in the United States because we're one of the few Western countries that does not tell pharmaceutical makers they can charge a certain amount for the drugs. Does that account for a lot of this price disparity?
Well, so you have to distinguish between price and total spending.
Okay.
And what you just said about the Rand report, I haven't seen that report. I'm not familiar with it. But if it's the total spending for the country or the total spending on average per person, that's not the same as the price.
I understood it. And we were coming after two different facts here. Yes, go ahead.
Right. So as you mentioned, some of that is accounted for by using more drugs, and some of that is accounted for by, perhaps by higher prices. I have seen some country-by-country comparisons between prices, and what you often find is that some drugs are more expensive in the U.S., and that's sometimes offset by other drugs that are less expensive in the U.S. For example, in Canada, they don't have nearly as much use of generics. So while a lot of individual drug prices are lower in Canada than in the U.S., that the average price is not necessarily lower. Now, again, another factor also is access to drugs. If you have a single-payer health system, then there can be regulations on who's allowed access to which types of drugs. And the doctor is not allowed to just prescribe any drug he or she thinks is appropriate. They have sets of rules in place that limit the number of prescriptions that can be issued.
Okay, hold on one second, if you would, Robert. I that is something I really wanted to dig into, and I'm glad you brought it up. Pinar, is that the case? When you look at single-payer systems, do you have patients who may be coming into a doctor in Scandinavia or in Canada and saying, no, I really want that specific drug, and that patient may not have access to that drug? And that's part of what this kind of regulation looks like.
That's certainly the case.
Robert, hold on a second. I'm asking our other guests this, if I may.
I'm sorry.
No problem. That's certainly the case that a lot of these countries, they actually use a system like a reference pricing system sometimes. So sometimes the formulary may just not have the drug cover, but sometimes you have a reference price that covers in a given therapeutic area certain drugs and at a certain reference price. And so the interesting thing about that is then the consumers would usually shift towards that drug, and the manufacturer prices may also respond closer to that reference drug as well. Some governments like Switzerland, they have a similar system, but they actually pay more for the value. So their formularies have more cost-effective drugs, and so they pay more for drugs that are more cost-effective, which is in sort of lay terms can be explained as that they provide more value for how much they cost.
Got it. Okay. So Robert, you were going to add.
So I was going to say that, for example, in the UK, each region has they have a single-payer national system, but they have the country divided into regions that they call trusts. And each trust, it's kind of like a school district. It goes by where you live.
Mm-hmm.
And some trusts will just decide that a certain drug is too expensive. And there's a national government organization called NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. And their standard is... They have, criteria for whether a drug is too expensive, and I believe the trusts have the final decision as to whether to cover it or not. But there are cases where patients have said, have been in situations where all the other treatments don't work, and there's one drug left, and it's too expensive. It may be one that's expensive in the U.S. as well, and the National Health Service won't pay for it, so they'll say, I'll pay for it myself.
Right.
And there was a bit, and that's called, they have a phrase for that. It's called topping up. And people have this idea that's very unfair, and if you go and buy your own drugs, you run the risk of losing your coverage under the single-payer system.
Let me take
It's considered, it's considered like if you're going to pay for it yourself, then you're out. You can't get any coverage at all. And not all trusts have done that. Some
That's kind of the exception to the rule, but I think we're...
It has certainly happened in certain trusts. Others have said... If it's like an intravenous drug that needs to be infused, we won't pay for infusing it, even if you bring it yourself. But we might treat you for unrelated conditions you have also. So if you get this drug for hepatitis C and then later you fall down the stairs and break your arm, you'll still get treatment for your broken arm.
Okay, let me take some calls on this. I don't want to focus on unusual exceptions here. I really want to understand how this works in other countries that use a single payer system, and what regulation would mean in our country. So to the callers, to Alex in Minneapolis. Hi, Alex. Appreciate you waiting. What's your story with the drugs that you're prescribed and you take?
Well, I'm on an antidepressant and have been on the same one for more than 8 years, and it's off of its patent. And in the span of about 14 months, I saw it go from under $500 for a month's supply to over 2,300.
Wow.
And that was just one of the meds.
And can you take a prescription that is a generic, not the name brand?
Actually, no. The generic for that antidepressant does not work for me.
Okay. This brings up something I wanted to ask you about, Pinar. I was reading something from the Food and Drug Administration, a study that they did on the price of brand name drugs going up by 110% between 2012 and 2016, even though, this is what the FDA found, that Americans aren't using brand name drugs as often. We are using more generics. What causes a price spike like that, even though the market would seem to be providing more access to generic drugs?
Yeah, so I mean, you highlighted an important issue, the access to the generic drugs, but which is by itself, I think, something that needs to be discussed, which is an important problem. But you sometimes have branded drugs that may not have alternatives, and sometimes you may have branded drugs that are off-patent even that still don't have comparable alternatives in the market, where you see some of these price hikes. I guess the big famous example of the Daraprim,
right,
where there was this big price hike. And these are pretty questionable pricing practices that that the government probably should be looking after and going after and using its regulatory authorities. The other things that can happen is sometimes you have a few drugs in the therapeutic class that are brand, but you have lack of competition in the sense that sometimes, like we've seen it in the insulins in the past, and which
you're
is a
for
behavior.
Diabetes?
Yes, so
I'm hearing from a lot of people who use insulin. Yeah,
we call this like a price fixing story where they have increased their prices in a step lock fashion, like within few days of each other, kind of like saying we're not going to price compete.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a market failure, where that's another room for when the government can intervene and try to correct some of these problems.
Robert, that sounds like a market failure. Does it look like one to you?
Well, so you have to be clear on what you mean by a market failure. If companies are colluding to increase prices, that's a you know, to say it's a market failure is understating the case. It's a felony violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And if that's really what's going on, they should be prosecuted. Simply observing price changes going like that is not enough to conclude that that's the case, but it might be. So that would call for some kind of I'd say that would call for a criminal investigation to see if they were colluding. However, it's possible that there's some reasonable explanation. Maybe it's that the inputs they use to make the drugs became more expensive in some way, or maybe there's some sort of a new FDA requirement on the manufacturing process that's more expensive. I don't have familiarity with that particular case, but if all you know is that prices have increased, then you have to look at multiple possibilities as to why it might have increased. Some sort of conspiracy like that is one possibility, but it's certainly not the only possibility.
I hear you. Do you feel that in that case, Robert, if you don't have a change in the manufacturing requirements and you are seeing drug makers say, well, this is what the market will bear, and so we're going to raise the price of this insulin or this other drug by what people will, figure out a way to pay for? Do you think is that a compelling enough reason for the federal government to step in and regulate prices?
If you're saying this is what the market will bear, the question is, why didn't the market bear that same price last month before they increased it?
Yeah, exactly.
So obviously something has changed, and you have to find out what's changed. And if perhaps there's a sudden increase in the demand for this product. Maybe more patients were diagnosed, or maybe the prescription guidelines have changed, and maybe they can't ramp up production fast enough. So essentially, the price is being bid up by the buyers, and
okay.
This is something that we see all the time in products where buyers are actually paying for their own goods, and with prescription drugs, there's usually someone else paying, like an insurance company or something, or some sort of a government program. So it's harder to. It's harder for this to happen in the case of prescription drugs than it is with, things like, apples or cars.
Okay. But Pinar, is there, I hear what Robert is saying about what else could be contributing to this decision
right.
that this pharmaceutical company is making. what often does contribute to the reason that a pharmaceutical company would decide to do this?
Just in general or in this
particular
example
where you see the spike? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think Robert is right. Sometimes manufacturing costs and things. But for most oral pharmaceuticals, I would argue that, you know, it's the R&D that is the bulk of the production
costs.
The research and development.
Costs.
And then after that, you know, producing that extra pill, the marginal cost of that is usually not that high. I'm, again, not for all drug classes, but more, you know, some of the more traditional cases. And in the case of insulins, I think that this was a case of the very clear sort of prices increasing within a few days of each other.
On Twitter, Mark says, my wife took Humira for psoriasis for the last 8 years. She was insured through a local school district, so the cost was minimal. She's now retired and is now covered by Medicare. Medicare will not cover Humira, so we're faced with about $4,000 in monthly costs. To the phones to Douglas in Minneapolis. And you're a physician, Douglas, yes?
Yeah, hi. I'm a medical oncologist and actually director of the Masonic Cancer Center at the university.
Good to have your call. What are you thinking about this?
So I'd like to make actually one point. Much of the research, actually almost all of the research for blockbuster drugs are done with the support of the federal government through the National Institutes of Health.
Mm-hmm.
I think drug companies very rarely, if ever, have an idea spring completely from their own research. Now, I'm not begrudging the companies the ability to take those basic discoveries and to turn them into drugs, and they should be rewarded for that. But on the other hand, I think it's important to understand that we already, as taxpayers, have a relationship with the drug companies that go to funding their basic business. The second part, and your guests have brought this up, the concept of market failure. So in my view, one of the biggest market failures is not allowing the federal government through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to negotiate with drug companies around price control. The president has not supported that concept, which is sort of moving through various legislative branches, but it's a very, in terms of why drug companies can set prices the way they do, it's because they can. You know, I think that in my field, and I take care of breast cancer patients, there are three drugs that do exactly the same thing, and they're priced exactly the same way, and companies pay for it. And I think it's largely because the companies are not allowed to negotiate with the federal government for better pricing.
You know, Douglas, it seems like the last opportunity for this was when Congress passed Medicare Part D, and I remember that there was a big debate about whether they were going to require that Medicare negotiate, and that didn't end up happening because Congress didn't pass that. What does that tell you about, I guess, what does it tell you about the influence of the pharmaceutical lobby? Or is there more to say about that? What's your sense of it?
No, I think that that's a very important part. I have several colleagues who work in the global oncology market. You know, for example, some of the very expensive drugs, and you see them advertised on television here, other countries have said they made a negotiation with the company to say, okay, we will give your single health care payer system access to this drug for free for 2 months. And if it works, then you have to pay. If we did that in the United States, I can't imagine, at least for the particular drug I'm thinking about, would the savings would be incredible because you only give pay for the drug if it actually works, and we don't have that policy.
Oh, either. I want to talk about that too, the value around pricing. But let me come back to you, Robert. Do I have my political history right here? The Congress had a big opportunity in Medicare Part D to pass this negotiation and didn't.
So actually, that's kind of oversimplifying it a bit. The Part D plans are operated by insurance companies, either nonprofit or for-profit insurance companies can submit a plan, and patients can pick which plan they want based on, you know, based on the drugs offered, the formulary, and based on the price of the plan. And the federal government subsidizes; they pay about 3/4 of the premium. And the for low income people they pay all of it, but for most people pay about 1/4 of the premium. The plan operators negotiate prices with the drug companies, and they have to compete with each other to get the drugs they want. And they have an incentive to ask for lower prices so they can offer a lower premium and attract more enrollees. And actually, this has been very successful. Medicare Part D runs at about just over half the cost it was originally forecast to operate.
It's about
45% below its original budget.
Yeah.
So and now if you had a single negotiator negotiating for all those people, they'd basically be making a take it or leave it offer to the drug companies. And if the drug companies get too low an offer, they just, you know, that drug just won't be available in Part D. And if they make too high an offer, then, you know, the taxpayers and the patients are paying too much.
Well, okay, two things there. This is interesting. I didn't realize that Medicare Part D was operating at about half the cost that it was projected to operate at. But is that, Pinar, is this right that drug prices could be more reasonable if Medicare Part D had the capability to negotiate? And are the consequences what Robert just described, where you might have a take-it-or-leave-it thing and some people wouldn't have access to needed prescriptions?
I actually would would agree with Robert on that point of Medicare Part D has been a very successful program. And the way Robert did describe, in the sense of you have these plans negotiating already for drug prices, is a big piece of it. In fact, and I know that over 90% of the public supports that the Medicare should just go ahead and negotiate. And this is something we can for sure think about. The proponents of this are exactly saying this is going to probably reduce prices. The opponents are worried about this issue of access, limiting access, like this take it or leave it kind of offers. Like, for example, the VA does negotiations, and the VA formulary does have fewer prescriptions covered. So that's definitely one of the issues. The other issue goes back to this fundamental question of whenever we do interfere the government to negotiate and use its monopsony power, then we're essentially regulating prices. And what does that do to the innovation? This big trade-off between innovation and prices, which can also be thought of about a trade-off between current generation and the future generation, right? Like we have access to statins for like penny a pill right now, but in the past, the previous generation, or actually us too, still like we had to pay for the higher prices. So that's the main issue. But one thing that's interesting to me is in 2007, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office actually took a look at that. And basically, they found that allowing Medicare Part D have a negotiation would actually have a negligible impact.
Negligible
impact on prices.
Okay.
Unless Medicare was also given the authority to do a formulary design, which is this general idea of like the big Medicare formulary, like you would have in a VA formulary. And that raises, again, I'm not opposed to thinking about calculating the pros and the cons of this, but that does raise other interesting questions of what that formulary would look like for, you know, what kind of drugs would be covered in it. And, for example, will each plan have a separate access to it? But there are definitely ways to think about it. There are ideas around reference pricing. Again, something that I mentioned before. There are ideas around paying for value and paying for outcomes that could try to design a formulary like that. But it's a major overtaking. It's not as simple stated as it is that Medicare will negotiate Part D and
everything
will be fine.
Solved. You're listening to a conversation today, and you can hear that this is complex with a lot of consequences on certain decisions about drug pricing. President Trump has been saying that he can solve expensive prescription drugs, and we're hearing our candidates for governor talk about this, and we wanted to examine some of the things that they're suggesting and then the complexity of doing something like this. Pinar Karaja-Mandich is with us. She's the academic director of the Medical Industry Leadership Institute at Carlson School, and Robert Book is with us. He's a physician and a health economist and senior research director at Libris Research, LLC. I'm asking you this morning if you are in a situation, as many Americans are, where prescriptions are so expensive they're almost out of reach for you. I also want to hear from you on what we're raising in this discussion about whether the federal government should be in the business of telling drug makers what they can charge. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR and to Jack in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Jack. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what'd you want to say?
I wanted to just touch on something that I think your guest, Pinar.
Yes, Pinar.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So whenever I hear about single payer or limiting drug prices, I just always think about limiting profit potential for pharmaceutical companies.
Uh-huh.
And so European countries, they benefit from our U.S. market profit potential, but they themselves limit prices and profit potential.
Uh-huh.
So I always think as an investor in a pharmaceutical company, well, what are you going to do with your money if your potential for profit is limited?
Is that your question, or you're saying what happens
would we see
the kind of innovation and research?
Else.
Yeah.
And limit medical advancement overall.
Okay. Pinar, that's one of the arguments that you hear.
Yeah, so exactly. That's one of the arguments, and that's an interesting one because it is very true. In the U.S., we care for innovation, and we make this trade-off. And we have decided to, as a country, have a patent and exclusivity system where we are going to give monopoly rights to the companies and let them essentially charge prices at a where the market can bear kind of a fashion rather mm-hmm. than regulating it in a like with a price ceiling or take we're not accepting it to our formulary kind of an approach. And I think your caller makes an important point that maybe it looks like we are essentially subsidizing other countries by paying higher drug prices at home. Right. And that is a very valid point. And this is something I'm not going to disagree with. But the one thing that I would say in terms of a nice analogy that another health economist friend of mine and I were thinking about was it's like in your own property lot, let's say it's like kind of like building a bigger house, right? You're building a bigger house yourself because you care for that bigger house. And just because you're building a bigger house, are you then going to ask your neighbor to pay for it because your neighbor is benefiting your bigger house because their property value is also going up. So it's in the economics jargon, like this is what we call a positive externality. You can say the same thing about like I make a beautiful garden and I benefit others and will the others benefit? So it does create a price differential where we are maybe overpaying and that the other countries are underpaying. In fact, this is some of the challenges that the Trump administration's blueprint has also highlighted that they want to fix this gap. And I'm not sure and what are some of the best ways to do it. Some of it could be done through, you know, importation. There is definitely an argument of drug importation.
I want to talk about that.
There is also other ways to do it, maybe through trade organization, trade policies and, you know, trying to equalize some of it. But there is also the other side of it. You know, the European countries, maybe one side of it, but like take other countries like India or, you know, that they cannot really afford to be able to bear with the high prices. And when we make this innovation price trade-off, what is really important about it is that innovation is great, but that innovation should at the end reach people, right? If the innovation doesn't reach people, then there is no value to it. So it's a difficult question, you know, maybe make other countries pay more, but at the same time, be mindful about some of the countries where access is a real, real issue.
So, Robert, as a health economist, we heard from Pinar the both sides of that debate. Where do you come down on this?
Right. So, by the way, I just want to clarify, I'm not a physician. I'm a health economist.
Ah, thank you. I thought you were an MD.
No, I have a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago.
Thank you.
What I would say is she's definitely made some excellent points that I agree with. And I want you to consider sort of play this thought experiment. If you're a drug company and suppose the United States passes a law that says you're not allowed to charge more in the United States than you charge in any other country. Well, what drug companies are doing right now is they're charging high prices in rich countries such as the United States and, you know, some of the European countries and lower prices in, you know, places like, you know, Mexico and India and Latin America and Africa. So they're sort of doing what economists call price discrimination. And this doesn't mean discrimination in the sense that we use this colloquially. It's just they're saying people who can pay lower prices, people who can't afford the higher prices get lower prices.
Uh-huh.
If we say the price has to be the same worldwide, then it's going to be difficult. You might end up in a situation where if they charge the
the poor country price in the U.S., they might not be able to make enough money to cover their research costs. So they have to charge a high price in the U.S., which means they have to charge a high price everywhere, which means the poor countries will not have access to the drug at all, which means they're spreading the research costs over fewer pills. You know, if you have the situation where the research is most of the cost,
yep,
and the actual drug is cheap, which is the case for most, but not all drugs, but most of them,
right,
then if you spread that cost over fewer drugs, the price in the U.S. might be the highest in the world now, and it might even have to go up if you put the companies in a situation where they can't sell at lower prices in poorer countries.
I see what you're saying.
So there you put us in a situation where other countries are hurt by losing access to the drugs, and we're hurt by paying even higher prices than we had to in the first place. And we actually saw something like this about 20 years ago when Congress passed a law that said Medicaid has to be given the lowest price that a drug company gives to any other payer. And what had prompted that was some insurance companies were getting discounts and rebates that made their price for the drugs lower than what Medicaid was paying.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, this isn't fair. If they can send it to this tiny little insurance population in Alabama for a lower price, why can't they give it to Medicaid for that lower price? And what happened is they stopped giving the discounts to everybody else, and the Medicare prices stayed the same or went up. They certainly didn't go down. And a year later, Congress wanted to investigate what had happened because they were so surprised. But if they'd asked an economist should have been able to tell them, this is exactly what's going to happen.
Which, by the way, is the case on a lot of issues. Let me do this. I have to get back to the phone since we have so many people waiting, to Michael in Albert Lea. Hi, Michael. What's your experience with this?
Yes, I've been taking extended release morphine for 10 years, and it is $500 a month if it was out of my pocket. I have Medicare Part D, but every year for the last 5 years, I've had to switch to a new company because the companies have to pay such a high percentage of that they keep raising my copay to the point I have to find a new company every year. And morphine has been on the market for over 100 years. It's not like it's some new experimental drug. So, you know, and then if I reach the donut hole toward the end of the year,
right,
I have to pay $500 a month is, you know, in November and December. I mean, it.
So, Michael, just so I understand this, you are switching insurers because the current insurer is gradually not covering most of the drug price, or do I have that?
Well, because they have to pay such a high percentage, like my copay out of that $500, say, is $47. The next year when I have, because you have to sign up for your Part D every year, so when I go to sign up the next year, they raise that copay either to some, you know, up near $100, or so I have to go and find another company that'll bring that copay back down again.
So Pinar, is this an issue with just individual insurance companies, or is this something about the way that drug is being priced?
I am actually not too sure in this case about the particular case of morphine, but the idea of, I mean, what I heard is that your caller is able to find some companies that are offering cheaper prices than the others. So there is definitely some kind of a competition in the market in that sense, in the Medicare Part D, in the coverage of the morphine. And it reflects this complex negotiation between drugs and manufacturing companies, and how these negotiations vary from company to company depending on the rebates they may be getting and things like that.
Okay. To a call here to Barry in St. Paul. Hi, Barry. You have some experience with this, it sounds like.
Yeah, I used to do R&D, our research anyway, for a large pharmaceutical company for a long time, and now I'm a nurse. I just want to add a couple of things. The R&D budgets of these companies are less than the lobbying and advertisement budgets. So I think that's something that needs to be taken into account when we're talking economics and cost increases. The increases in the price of meds, Mr. Robert was talking about that. It's really speculation. It could have to do with some kind of manufacturing cost. But It doesn't necessarily have to do with that. It could have to do with lobbying and lawmaking. It's all speculation except by senior management. Rationing of care is going on right now, as you guys have been talking about, though you haven't called it that. And single payer would just mean a change in what the rationing looks like.
I see.
And I agree, that is really tricky. I don't have much confidence in either Congress or the senior management of any of these companies. And in terms of the cost of some common meds like morphine, like your previous caller spoke, the formulation of these things and how we get it into our bodies, what has to come along, excipients and carrier stuff, sometimes that's really expensive. I don't want to make excuses for these price jumps that your callers have seen. I kind of doubt they're necessary, certainly not from a research point of view. But the formulations do make a difference, even if the active product is very simple.
Okay. So yeah, I appreciate the call. Robert, one of the things I heard in a lot of what Barry said there was that there is an arbitrariness to some of these pharmaceutical companies' decisions on pricing. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I would be very surprised if you made – if you had millions and billions of dollars on the line, I would be very surprised if you made a decision arbitrarily. It's you might – you know, you wouldn't be doing your job if that's what you did. I would like, he did mention lobbying, and I would like to say something about that.
Okay.
Companies lobby. The reason companies spend money on lobbying, the same reason they spend money on everything else, is they think it's profitable. And the reason it might be profitable is the government makes a lot of decisions and issues a lot of regulations that affect the company's ability to do business. So if you give the government more power to regulate more strictly or more precisely or more aspects of the market, then you're going to end up with a lot more being spent on lobbying, because that's the only way the company can stay in business. If you want to eliminate lobbying, you have to make lobbying not profitable. And to make lobbying not profitable, you have to make it. You know, there's only two ways to do that. One is the congressman can stop listening to the lobbyists. They could do that. If they did that tomorrow, there'd be no more lobbying. And the second is, you could just not regulate so much and not regulate so tightly, and then the profit would go out of lobbying.
Well, as you know, I mean, I don't know that that's the only choice. I mean, you know, perhaps Congress could act in the interest of Americans and not necessarily in the interest of the pharmaceutical. I know why they lobby, but I don't think it's black or white as stop regulating and then they wouldn't have to lobby, or.
Well, it's stop regulating and then there wouldn't be any point to lobbying. It would be a waste. You want to make
companies lobby for a lot of different reasons,
right? And if you, but they all involve, you know, helping trying to influence,
right, Congress to do something that's in the interest of the company that's lobbying, right?
Right, and if Congress doesn't get into the detail, and not just Congress, I mean, sometimes they lobby regulatory agencies as well.
Yeah,
and if the government didn't assert so much power over factors that affect the company's bottom line, there would be no incentive to lobby.
I think many Americans
created a situation
believe that the government doesn't exert enough power over, and that's why we're talking about it today, over drug pricing.
Yeah, so many people certainly do believe that, and what I think you have to understand is that if you assert more power,
If you regulate more, they're going to lobby more, you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's actually from the standpoint of company management that has a fiduciary duty to their stockholders to keep the company going.
I guess they would have to decide whether that's the right investment, right? I mean,
right.
If there was more regulation, maybe if there was more regulation, the companies would have to accept that and they wouldn't spend as much on lobbying because it would already be a done deal.
But lobbies, they always have to update things. If they're regulating the prices of new drugs, every time a new drug is introduced, they have to go before some regulatory body and try to get a price for it. That's lobbying.
And you didn't really acknowledge what I said. I mean, if Congress passed some kind of federal drug regulation, pricing regulation, the companies could maybe stop lobbying on that and spending money on that and put some of that money back into R&D.
I guess what I'm saying is that wouldn't be a done deal, because if they pass a law saying drug prices are going to be set and they're going to be set by, you know, some commission, then everybody, all the drug companies are going to have to go to the commission to try to get their prices set. You know, it's never a done deal when you start regulating.
I got you. Pinar, what would you say about this?
Well, I'm not a political scientist, so I will have less to say about the lobbying aspect of it. But one thing that I do want to bring up is, you know, when we talk about market failures in economics, like why aren't markets, you know, working efficiently? You know, one of the things that does come up is lack of information. Mm-hmm. So, and I think like I view information, lack of information and transparency as one of the reasons why we may be seeing some of the market practices that we see as well. For example, like one of the biggest things is like research and development costs, right? When researchers try to infer it, they always have to go to the back roads of, you know, they look at the SEC filings of these publicly traded companies to sort of back out R&D expenditures and things like that. And there are some studies that show that R&D is not as high, but some show the opposite, etc. But I think one thing that is interesting that is coming up is the states are going after this a little bit more and asking for more drug price transparency. Unfortunately, in Minnesota, we don't have a drug price transparency law, but these laws would actually be interesting. They're essentially, in a way, putting pressure on the companies to justify some of these price hikes because they're asking them to report some of these things that go into the actual drug pricing and research and development. Some states, like California, has one, for example, that passed last year. Five other states passed these drug price transparency laws this year. Ours got forwarded on. But
in so state legislatures, you're saying, can look at the breakdown of spending and
they can
see,
ask,
see how much lobbying, see what's been spent on marketing, lobbying.
Well, lobbying, I don't know if it's part of that. For sure, marketing, research and development, the production kind of costs. But if we have a system like that, then if there is one of these price hikes, and some of it could be justifiable, but some of it maybe not. But then it could be the state legislator could be asking for justification of certain price hikes.
Robert, I wanted to ask you about something that the Trump administration has suggested, and that is competing with, given the fact, I think we had our oncologist call earlier and say, you know, the federal government also invests in this research. How about the idea of setting up some kind of public competition to these patents? And this is something that Dr. Adam Gaffney was writing about in the Washington Post after the president announced his plan. And Gaffney says, well, let's just take the president's plan one step further. Why not go all the way and set up a public program parallel to compete with the private firms in developing and testing new drugs and keep those publicly developed drugs outside the patent system? What about that idea?
So that's kind of an interesting idea. It was our caller Douglas, I think, the oncologist, who said that the government's doing a lot of the research. The government does, on a dollar value basis, the government does about a third of the medical research in this country, and the drug companies do about two-thirds. Mm-hmm. So the government does do a significant fraction, but it's certainly not all of it. That's something you have to understand. And if the federal government went into the business of producing drugs and competing with drug companies, that would essentially be a taxpayer-subsidized competitor in the marketplace, the same as all the others.
Right.
And we've had that in certain areas, and that tends to drive out, you know, everybody else.
Who's everybody else? You mean the private companies?
That might drive all the companies out of the business. I'd have to look at his, I didn't see his article, so I'd have to look at that precisely.
Here's what he adds, and this might be interesting to you. He says these new drugs could immediately be manufactured cheaply as generics, and then research could be directed towards the drugs that are most needed, not the most profitable. That sound like good reasoning to you?
Well, how do you know what's most needed? People are willing to pay high prices for drugs that save lives.
That comes back to, putting value on.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Yeah. Uh-huh. Suppose you put laws in place to limit the profit from cancer drugs because people really need these to survive, and it's not fair to make profit off of people whose lives are on the line. But if it's some sort of a cosmetic drug, like, you know, for a drug for male pattern baldness, then you can charge whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go with the, now suppose that kind of a system is in place, and imagine yourself in the position of a drug company manager, and you've got to decide where to direct your research to, and your stockholders are saying you better make a profit or you're fired.
I see your point.
So are you going to go into cancer drugs where your profit's limited, or into male pattern baldness where it's not limited?
Maybe it depends on the volume of people that would be using either drug. I hear what you're saying on the baldness.
Well, there are a lot of people with male pattern baldness. That's much more common than cancer.
I do hear what you're saying.
And it's, it, you know, I mean, you know, I have male pattern baldness, and it's not, I don't particularly enjoy it, but it's not going to kill me. But I don't necessarily want to live in a society where it's legal to profit off of male pattern baldness, but not off of curing cancer.
Pinar, that's a good argument.
I would agree with him on this point. Another kind of an interesting argument that I heard was the Nobel Prize winning economist Joe Stiglitz, who basically said, well, how about a system where we have prize funds? I mean, all of this goes back to
price
this, you know,
funds,
to fund prizes.
Okay,
right. So in a way, like, we establish these funds, and the innovators of these amazing high value drugs get these big prizes.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of like a substitute for like the existing patent system, perhaps.
Yes.
But I think I would agree with Robert on that. NIH has a role, but NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and other, you know, government funding, its role should be well defined in terms of helping out and subsidizing research, but not necessarily trying to distort the market for developing new drugs.
I think I can get a call in here from Jeff in Alexandria. Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for waiting. Would you want to add to this real quickly, if you could?
Thanks for taking my call. I think all of this conversation is real important to remember that we have a free market economy system, including for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And so the potential for profit drives all of the innovation and advancement. I wanted to kind of step back to the idea of the federal government negotiating prices for Medicare. The federal government in Part D has deferred that process to the Part D plans, and the Part D plans individually negotiate for lower prices with each drug manufacturer.
Right.
So you can
I think we covered that.
You can either choose to have the federal government do it or the Part D plans, but you can't have both.
Uh-huh.
And the one of the differences there is if you look at the VA, they have a formulary, and they cover certain drugs, and they don't cover other drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need a drug that they don't cover, too bad.
Yeah, I think we covered this at the beginning of the show, Jeff. You might not have heard it. Did you want to add something to this?
One of the other things that is important to understand is the free market system in terms of the Part D plans negotiating for rebates. The plans get to keep a portion of the rebate that they collect from the manufacturer to reduce the drug price. So the more rebates the plan collects, the more profit the plan makes.
Okay.
Which creates a financial incentive for the drug manufacturer to raise their price and raise their rebate in order to get a more favorable position on the formulary.
Robert, Jeff, I'm sorry. You're going over some information that we already talked about, but Robert, that last part with the rebates and the incentive to raise the prices, is that right? And is that a flaw in the system?
Well, there is a there's a complicated system of rebates where they sell to the pharmacies at the same price, and then give rebates to the drug companies that pay for the drugs. It's a complicated system, and there ought to be more transparency. Because there's not that much transparency, I can't say definitively if that results in a net increase or a decrease in what the consumers end up paying or what the premiums end up being.
Pinar, do you think do you think there's the political will to really do something in Congress on this? We've been talking about this forever.
In general, or the rebate issue?
No, in general.
In general, I mean, I've looked at the Trump administration blueprint, and
yeah.
I think there is good progress, especially in terms of facilitating entry of new drugs and new generics. And they have passed a lot of laws and acts and action plans that are trying to deal with issues around expediting the process, that are trying to deal with issues around brands preventing in different ways these generics coming. So there's a lot of good progress on that. And the other thing that I'm very excited...
Forgive me, as I said, we had about a minute. We're almost out of time. Good to have you here. Robert, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
If you
want to listen to more details of the conversation, find it in the podcast.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.